This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
I'm Dave Brown, and this is a podcast version of AMI's Morning Show, now with Dave Brown. Catch the live broadcasts weekdays from 9 to 11 a.m. Eastern on AMI Audio and AMI TV. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. It's Friday, so let's assemble the weekly news panel. Michelle McQuigg and Joita Gupta are standing by, so let's welcome them into the show. Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning, Dave.
And hello, Joita.
Hey, Dave.
So we've got quite a bit to discuss today, and let's get into our first topic. Major General Danny Fortin lost his bid Tuesday to be reinstated as the head of Canada's COVID-19 vaccine rollout, a position he lost in May amid a sexual misconduct investigation. Meanwhile, the Canadian military has postponed the appointment of its next commander of the Army because the man it picked for the role is being investigated for misconduct himself. Lieutenant General Trevor Cadieux was set to be sworn in as the head of Canada's Army at a ceremony in September. This is, of course, as the military is still reeling from the removal of General Jonathan Vance, who also faced accusations of sexual misconduct. These issues have implicated other officers tasked with handling internal complaints of misconduct. I know this might seem like a bit of a sharp turn, but it has me thinking about who might be named Minister of Defense in the new cabinet and how they might try to address the issues of sexual misconduct within the ranks. And guys, we know the defense portfolio was always an important one, but does the magnitude of misconduct necessitate the appointing of someone to cabinet who can really lay the hammer down? What do you think, Joita?
It's a great point, Dave. I think there's a couple of things to think about here. For one thing, there are rumors that say that the next defense minister, to your point, it's an important role. The next defense minister will likely be a woman. If Harjit Sajjan remains in the role, there's a perception that it will clearly send the wrong message, so the government isn't taking this seriously. So there's a couple of people who are being considered now as a possible replacement to fill that job. Anita Anand is one contender, and she's believed to be someone who would very seriously take action. Another person who's being considered is Carla Qualtrough, as well as as Anita Van Belt, who was the parliamentary secretary. Now, with Anita Van Belt, there's a little bit of people are a little hesitant about her candidacy or her nomination just because she has spoken out favorably about Harjit Sajjan's track record. But generally speaking, that track record is not looking good for the Liberals. The class action lawsuit that that involves many service women is, you know, growing in numbers, and of course that's going to be a huge that's going to have implications for Canadian taxpayers. It's one of those issues where even Chrystia Freeland has come out and said that clearly, as far as the military is concerned, top leadership just doesn't seem to get it. So it really feels like change is in the air, and there are some clear signs that the next defense minister will likely be a woman. As to whether that itself will translate into cultural change, that's the bigger question.
Joita, that was really well put. There was a lot in that response, and I think there's a lot to unpack there, but I want to give Michelle a chance to generally react to sort of the overall perception of what we should be looking for in regards to the importance of this position at this moment.
Yeah, Joita really did capture it extremely well. I have been reading and hearing a lot of the same things. There's something to be said for the fact that we're practically a month away from the last federal election. That was on September 20th. It's now the 15th. We have not yet seen a cabinet, but chatter about the defense minister started as early as 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. So this really clearly is a fairly high priority, high ticket topic right now. I've been hearing the same names as Joita floated around in really broad strokes. Nothing huge to go on here, but the rumor mill is churning in some of those names for sure. I've been hearing them as well. An issue, though, to be considered along those lines in terms of those candidates specifically, yes, they're women, and there is definitely a push for Canada to have another female defense minister. We had one very briefly, and she was a classic example, though, of why this issue is so complicated. Kim Campbell is widely considered to have been set up for failure in the conservative ranks, both as defense minister and as prime minister. And a lot of people are now saying that if you're going to do this, if you're going to parachute a woman in to fix a problem, to step into a situation that's known to be fraught and problematic, that you can't set her up for failure. Mm-hmm. You need to make sure she's the right person in the role. You need to make sure that she's here to address things and given the tools to do that. And you most importantly need to make sure that if things don't change, she isn't deemed to be the problem and blamed for all of it. So, again, lots to unpack there. But the female minister aspect is a big one to consider, one that's been getting a lot of traction and analysis. But again, no one has talked about the fact that there are no women's names being floated around that are coming up through the ranks or that have past experience. Mm-hmm. And that could well be a factor when appointing a defense minister as well.
I'm so glad that both of you picked up on that notion of whether or not the minister should be a woman, because that was something that jumped out to me as well. And it's always a dangerous game because you don't want to say, well, it's up to women to fix misogyny and sexism in the military. But I do think there's an important leadership role that can be played there, a gravitas that goes along with the position. But you're 100% right there, Michelle, to identify this can't just be a token hire. You need to give them the tools and the resources to address the issue head on and give them sort of that unwavering support, which then maybe leads me into something that you've heard me talk about on the show before, which is the idea of splitting a ministry or thinking about multiple portfolios inside a ministry. So, Juita, what do you think of the idea where we might actually benefit from two ministers, someone to deal with the day-to-day operations of national defense and someone who's tasked particularly with addressing the policies and procedures regarding sexual misconduct?
I hope you don't mind, Dave, but in this case, we'll have to agree to disagree. I don't think that this is the way to go. In the past in Canada, we've had associate defense ministers. I think there was one during the Second World War. I don't see a particular need for a secondary position or even for a second position, even if you create those positions on equal footing right now. It's not like Canada's embroiled in conflict. We just withdrew from Afghanistan, as you know, and that was a significant military engagement. This is the issue of the day. It's an issue that has long been neglected. I mean, there was a report that came out in 2015. It was a task force headed up by a former Supreme Court justice who talked about this toxic climate for women and LGBTQ members of the armed forces. So this is an issue that has long been neglected. And my worry is that a lot of our armed forces, the military, works as a hierarchy. And the moment you split up the portfolio, it opens up this whole can of worms. Mm-hmm. Who do you actually report to? Who gets a larger budget? Who is more qualified? Who gets listened to and who gets dismissed? So I think this particular idea now, I mean, we can revisit it if Canada gets embroiled in a war, for example, or if there's some significant conflict that comes up, then yes, in the interest of making sure that this issue actually finally gets dealt with, let's split it up in that instance. But we don't need to do this right now.
Juita, I'm glad you disagreed with me because even as I wrote the question down for you guys earlier in the week, I said to myself, if you have two leaders on this file, do you actually have no leaders on this file? So I think that's really well put. Michelle, your thoughts on the idea of splitting the ministry?
It was interesting. I actually got to treat this as a bit of a debate and consider Dave's proposal and hear Joita's rebuttal and decide where I land. So that was because I wasn't sure. But Joita, I think you've persuaded me. The biggest concern I would have is that the issue of sexual misconduct and treatment of women within the armed forces would remain siloed if we were to split things up. Mm-hmm. And that it would continue to be seen as a separate matter that requires separate handling from different people, whereas what I think everyone is pushing for is actual deep-rooted cultural change that is deeply and fundamentally integrated into the system. So I think probably the best way to accomplish that is to have it all in one house.
Michelle, I want to come back to you because you mentioned a little bit earlier the idea of where service in the military may be an impactful qualification for what we're looking for in this minister. How much do you think military service matters in regards to a qualification to take on the portfolio of defense?
I feel like I'm poorly positioned to answer this one because military culture is so much of its own thing and it's one that I don't have my finger on the pulse of. Mm-hmm. So I strongly suspect that there would be a stronger appetite among the rank and file to see someone with combat experience or at least armed forces experience in this kind of a role. That was certainly seen as a major selling point for Harjit Sajjan when he first took the portfolio, and I believe he's held it since the beginning of the Trudeau administration,
That's
since
right.
2015.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So that definitely was seen and sold as a real asset. Obviously, that cachet has long worn off, and that's no longer a factor. So perhaps the conversation has changed enough that people are willing to stray away from that. And obviously, there have been ministers in the past without that kind of background. But I definitely do think it would be seen as an asset at the very least.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely see how it's an asset, and obviously it would offer some expertise, but sometimes the possibility of having an outside voice, outside eyes and ears on these things can actually help you shake up the culture, because every now and then there are these moments where you might just shrug because you're so embroiled in a culture of something. Juita, what do you think about the qualification in regard to a service in the military as being an important part of taking on this portfolio?
I want to say that on a perfunctory level, it makes a lot of sense. I think the military culture is pretty insular, and so they would welcome someone heading up the defense ministry who has lived experience. But the fact of the matter is, I mean, this is just a practical consideration. There aren't actually that many people in the cabinet right now with service experience. Mm-hmm. Harjit Sajjan is obviously one of them. The other one is Mark Garneau, who you know, is a contender, but there'll probably be a step down. Oh, and there is Aaron O'Toole, but somehow I don't see that one working out. So. So
your optimism is so cute.
So anyways, my point being, I think that there have also been a number of civilians who've headed up the role. The point about qualifications, David Michelle, isn't whether it's a woman who's in the top job. For me, that's not the big question. It isn't about whether the person has service experience. For me, the question is, what kind of a leader are you? Do you have the strength of character to try and deal with this deeply entrenched culture? Because one of the issues with the military is that it is very self-regulating. It's the classic case of the fox watching the hen house. And you need someone with the wherewithal to stand up to institutional indifference that has spanned years, if not decades. And it's, you know, you need to be the kind of person who can really hold people within the military accountable.
Juita, I'm glad you raised that, because that leads me into my last question here in regards to, is the politics side of this perhaps something of a window dressing? Because over and over again, we're seeing high-ranking members and officers at that level being implicated in these scandals. So when we're talking about that kind of reform, how much does that need to come from the accountability within? And I say this because even as I was preparing for today, at one point I thought about doing a chronology of all the scandals we've seen at the officer level in just the last 12 months. And I realized it was going to take me a good hour to put all that together, and it was going to take me a good 5 to 6 minutes to read it all on the air. Just the number of officers either being implicated themselves or being the ones tasked with handling the human resources side of this, handling the complaints, being implicated in conflict of interest scenarios. It just seems, Juita, as you identified, the institution is dealing with this systemically. So although the politics side is important, how much does accountability need to start coming from within the organization?
It's one of those. So this morning, just a couple of minutes before I got on the panel, I read an op-ed in the National Post. It was written by someone called Catherine Marshall, who I believe is an employment lawyer and is involved with this class action lawsuit that I talked about in some capacity. And she basically referred to it, her words, not mine, as a complete farce to think that the military can self-regulate. She said that, first of all, let's back up a little bit here. We're in a parliamentary democracy. And this idea that this is a peculiarity of the military, that they have their own police, they have their own justice system, they have their own parallel institutions. And I love that word silo that Michelle picked up on a few minutes ago, and I want to return to it because, yes, you know, we are talking about this in the aftermath of the Me Too movement, but because of the siloed nature of the military, that hasn't really percolated into the rank and file. Now, do I think that you need buy-in from the military? Absolutely. But do I think that it's going to be the military itself that reforms? You know, I don't think so, because I think it's self-evident, at least to me, that policing has failed within the military.
Yeah. I mean, there's a contradiction even in the way I posed that question, right? To say whether or not the politics is window dressing when we know that the administration at the top levels, at the officer level, is failing to deal with this issue. But Michelle, what do you make of that balancing act sort of between the politics side but internal accountability as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we can all agree internal accountability is huge, which of course speaks to some of the credibility issues we talked about in terms of the defense minister, who was ostensibly the leader. But we also saw this very week how complex the intersection between military and non-military procedures can be. And that was through the Danny Fortin case, Dave, that you used to mention off the top here. He was fighting to be reinstated, and the court dismissed that. And the grounds that they used, they said that you haven't really proven that this falls outside the scope of normal military disciplinary procedure. So the message was essentially, go through that first, and then if that doesn't work, then you can come back, and then we'll talk and see what happens. So that really is the de facto way to deal with even really complex matters like this one with high-ranking people when there is a political element involved, because there are lots of accusations that this was a politically driven move. So even in those situations, things seem to get sent back in-house to be dealt with internally, and that speaks to exactly how sequestered and cloistered military culture can be, and to what degree everything has to be in order internally if there's going to be any kind of change. At least that's my take on things.
Guys, I can't thank you enough for your perspective and thoughts on this issue. Thank you for visiting it with me. And I should mention, just as we're wrapping up here, City News is reporting this morning that the cabinet will be announced October the 26th. October the 26th is the expected date for the new cabinet to be named in Canada. Coming up next, as a major strike could be on the horizon for workers in the TV and film industry, we examine the issues and the potential disruption coming to creating content. This is the Now News Panel on AMI. You've been listening to Now with Dave Brown. Hit the subscribe button on any podcast platform and leave us a rating and a review.